I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
My children and I were at home, working and relying on God for support when the Israeli enemy hit us. They are just children, but it seems as if Israel is saying it's too much for us to even have a home.
Israel continues its bombardment of Lebanon with airstrikes across the country. Nearly 600 people have been killed, including over 50 children. Tens of thousands of people have fled their homes. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launches dozens of rockets at Israel, including a long-range missile fired at Tel Aviv that was intercepted. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then here in the United States, Election Day is less than 6 weeks away. We'll be joined by Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein.
My name is Jill Stein. I am the Green Party presidential nominee. And I'm here to lift up the voice of the people who say no to this genocide, who say no to the Democratic Party, who say no to the Republican Party.
We'll also speak with Green Party vice presidential candidate Butch Ware. And Fuerza Mexicana, the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez on his new report. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tens of thousands of people have fled southern Lebanon as Israel's military continues its intense artillery and missile attacks. Lebanon's health ministry reports the death toll has climbed to at least 599 people, including 50 children. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launched dozens of drones and rockets at Israel, including a long-range missile fired toward Tel Aviv that was intercepted by Israeli air defense systems. Israeli public media is reporting Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is readying troops for a possible ground invasion of Lebanon. In Beirut, officials say they've secured shelters for 10,000 people displaced from southern Lebanon. Some of the evacuees were forced into the same shelters they fled to nearly two decades ago during Israel's July 2006 assault. This is Felia Messen, a 58-year-old man who narrowly survived, a strike that destroyed her family home.
The rocket landed in front of me. I was shocked. I couldn't hear or see after that. Dust was all over the place, so I drove off quickly and headed to the upper road and kept going. I lost my temper because of what happened. It took me 12 to 15 hours to reach Beirut from Aitut because of the traffic congestion.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reports two United Nations staffers were among those killed by Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon. Ali Basma worked as a janitor at the UNHCR's Tyre office for 7 years before he was killed in an Israeli strike on Monday. And Dina Darwish, a UNHCR staffer featured in many of the agency's videos, was killed along with her youngest son in an Israeli strike that seriously injured her husband and her other child. A separate Israeli strike killed cameraman Kamel Kariki of Al-Manar TV. He's at least the fifth journalist killed by Israeli attacks on Lebanon since October 7th. Meanwhile, Israel's military has continued its attacks on the Gaza Strip, with at least 53 Palestinians killed over the last 24 hours. Among the dead are a mother killed along with her five children when Israel's military bombed their house north of Rafah. In occupied West Bank, four Palestinians were shot and wounded as Israeli soldiers raided the Fawar refugee camp south of Hebron. Elsewhere, a Palestinian doctor was hospitalized in serious condition after he was shot by Israeli forces during a raid near the city of Qalqilia. Here in New York, world leaders gathered for the United Nations General Assembly Tuesday condemned Israel's assaults on Palestine and Lebanon. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza and said the failure of nations to stop the violence showed the United Nations system and Western values are dying. Chilean President Gabriel Boric also condemned Israel's actions.
Me niego a elegir entre el terrorismo de Hamas.
I refuse to choose between the Hamas's terrorism or the massacre and genocidal behavior of Netanyahu's Israel. We do not have to choose between barbarities. I choose humanity. We denounce the illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories and the de facto denial of the existence of an independent Palestinian state by the occupying country.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused Israel of violating the United Nations Charter and said too many governments are turning a blind eye to international human rights conventions and the decisions of international courts. Meanwhile, Joe Biden delivered his last speech to the United Nations as U.S. president, calling for a diplomatic solution to end Israel's war on Gaza, even as his administration continues to provide weapons and billions of dollars in aid to Israel's military.
Working to bring greater measure of peace and stability to the Middle East. The world must not flinch from the horrors of October 7th. Any country would have the right and responsibility to ensure that such an attack can never happen again.
In Ukraine, at least three people were killed and nearly three dozen injured Tuesday as a Russian bomb tore through an apartment block in Kharkiv. Ukraine's military says it shot down scores of Iranian-made drones launched by Russia as part of a wave of attacks that coincided with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to the United Nations General Assembly. This comes as the Biden administration says it's sending Ukraine another $375 million in military aid, including rockets, artillery, and medium-range cluster bombs. The Arizona Democratic Party says a campaign office for Vice President Kamala Harris in Tempe was damaged by gunfire overnight Tuesday. It's the second time bullet holes have appeared in the office's windows in recent weeks. Harris is planning to visit Arizona in the coming days, where she's reportedly planning to visit the U.S.-Mexico border. Meanwhile, in Ohio, a Haitian immigrant rights group has brought criminal charges against Donald Trump and J.D. Vance over their false claims that Haitian immigrants living in Springfield are stealing and eating dogs and cats. Ohio state law allows private citizens to file affidavits bringing criminal charges. The Haitian Bridge Alliance wants Trump and Vance prosecuted for disrupting public services, making false alarms, telecommunications harassment, and aggravated menacing. Last week, the group's executive director, Gerline Joseph, spoke with Democracy Now!
Those type of narratives, when they think they're only attacking one person, one community, it has ripple effects. The reality now in Springfield, the entire community's lives are at risk. And what we are saying is currently this has been a tactic that's being used, fear, division. And this is a time for all people in cities like Springfield to come together and fight against those hateful speech that literally occurs, creating the security issues in Springfield and also in other places across the United States.
To see the full interview with Gerline Joseph of Haitian Bridge Alliance, go to democracynow.org. West Virginia Independent Senator Joe Manchin says he will not endorse Kamala Harris for president after she reiterated her support for ending the Senate filibuster. She told Wisconsin Public Radio this week she would seek to lower the threshold to pass legislation from 60 senators to a simple majority of 51 in order to restore abortion rights lost when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. That prompted this response by Senator Manchin.
Shame on her. Shame on her. She knows that filibuster is the holy grail of democracy.
Senator Manchin previously joined Republicans to filibuster the Women's Health Protection Act, which would have codified abortion rights into federal law. The chancellor of New York City's public school system is stepping down amidst a growing federal bribery investigation. David Banks' announcement comes just weeks after FBI agents raided his home and seized his phone. He's at least the fourth top official to resign from Mayor Eric Adams' administration over a sprawling federal corruption probe, which, among other things, is looking into whether Adams' campaign received illegal donations from Turkey. Recently, Adams' lawyer abruptly resigned. The state of Missouri has executed Marcellus Williams, despite new evidence suggesting he was wrongfully convicted. Williams died by lethal injection Tuesday evening after the U.S. Supreme Court denied a stay. He was 55 years old, a devout Muslim, an imam for other incarcerated people, and a poet. Jurors, the prosecutor, and the murder victim's family all begged that he not be killed. To see our coverage of his case, visit democracynow.org. Meanwhile, Texas prison officials killed Travis James Mullis on Tuesday. He's the fourth person to face lethal injection in Texas so far this year and the 16th nationwide, part of five executions scheduled across the United States this week. This comes as Texas lawmakers are urging authorities to grant clemency to death row prisoner Robert Roberson, who was convicted in 2003 for the murder of his two-year-old daughter, but has always maintained his innocence. Roberson's conviction was solely based on forensic testimony that cited the shaken baby syndrome hypothesis, which was popularized in the early 2000s, but never scientifically validated. Roberson is scheduled to be put to death October 17th. This is Texas State Representative Joe Moody of El Paso.
You cannot execute someone in a situation where there may not have been a crime committed. And the evidence in Mr. Roberson's case is of such a degree and such a magnitude that we have to push pause on this case. There is no disagreement that the government taking the life of an innocent person is wrong. And until we have these answers, this case cannot move forward.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
At least 22 people have been killed in Lebanon today as the Israeli military continues its bombardment across Lebanon. Israel's expanding the zones of attack with strikes for the first time on the beach resort town of Jiya, just south of Beirut, and Ma'isra in the mountains in the north. The death toll over the past 3 days is nearly 600 killed, including over 50 children, 40 women, with more than 1,800 people wounded. Tens of thousands have fled southern Lebanon, many going to Beirut and the coastal city of Sidon, and are sleeping in schools and parks in their cars. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reports two United Nations staffers were among those killed by Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon. Ali Basma worked as a janitor at the UNHCR's Tyre office for 7 years before he was killed in Israeli strike Monday. And Dina Darwish, a 12-year staff member of UNHCR's Beqa office, who was featured in UNHCR videos, was killed along with her son in an Israeli strike that seriously injured her husband and another of their children. Another Israeli strike killed cameraman Kamel Karaki of Al-Manar TV. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launched dozens of rockets at Israel, including a long-range missile fired toward Tel Aviv that was intercepted by Israeli air defense systems. The UN Security Council scheduled an emergency meeting on Lebanon today at the request of France. For more, we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Aya Mesjoub. She's Amnesty International's Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome to Democracy Now!. Aya, since you're right there in Beirut, just describe the scene on the ground in the country.
I mean, the onslaught that started Monday was really unprecedented. We saw tens and tens and tens of thousands of families hastily pack up their bags, leave their homes without any idea where they're going to next. All across Beirut now, you see cars that are parked with displaced families that have nowhere to go. The strikes have been expanding. There's a lot of misinformation around. People are paranoid about another pager walkie-talkie attack. I mean, the situation is really devastating. And Amy, there's, you know, I really want to put the death count into perspective here. In a single day, on Monday, more than 500 people were killed. And that is a really astounding number. It is one of the highest daily death tolls in recent global wars. It is higher than most daily death tolls in Gaza in the past year. You know, in Gaza, despite the horrific Israeli onslaught, it took 18 days for the death count to reach 500. This happened in Lebanon in about 24 hours. In 2006, the 33-day war that took place between Hezbollah and Israel resulted in 1,100 deaths over 33 days. We've already achieved half of that in just 24 hours. So the numbers are really unprecedented, and you see major panic across the entire country. People don't know where is safe anymore. The Israelis have expanded the areas that they're targeting. They're not limited to some areas in South Lebanon along the border and in the Bekaa. They've really expanded inwards into coastal cities, into mountains in the north. It really feels like nowhere is safe, and people are very much at a loss for what to do and where to go.
And Aya, what about these phone calls and text messages and also reports of dropping of leaflets on the population by the Israelis? How are people reacting to that? And what indication do they have of even where to go?
So on Monday, the information minister said that around 80,000 people received calls to evacuate. And we tried to look into some of those calls, and there didn't seem to be any pattern for who was receiving these calls. Some people in Beirut received them. Some people in the south received them. In the Bekaa, it was really all across the country. So it seemed like a tactic that was more intended to cause fear rather than an actual evacuation. Some residents in South Lebanon did get more specific evacuation orders. But again, under international law, for evacuation orders to mean anything, they have to be effective, meaning that people must have the time to leave and they must have the means to do so. What we saw on Monday was anything but. I mean, you know, people, the instructions that people got were stay away from Hezbollah targets. Nobody knows. A civilian doesn't know where a Hezbollah target is. So people just fled with the clothes off their back. It took 14, 15 hours for some families to make it from South Lebanon to Beirut. And we were receiving reports that that there were some strikes on, near where civilians were gathered to evacuate in traffic jams. We're still looking into those. But if that, holds up, then that is also a serious violation.
And I wanted to ask you that Amnesty is calling for an international investigation into the deadly attacks using these exploding portable devices. Could you talk about what you're calling for and why? And why isn't this patently labeled as a terrorist attack?
So under international humanitarian law and human rights law, we don't use the term terrorist attacks. For us, attacks are either lawful or unlawful. Our qualification of the pager attacks is if, as is being reported and as U.S. officials and Lebanese officials have said, Israel was behind the attacks, then international humanitarian law applies because these attacks were part of an armed conflict. Under international humanitarian law, it is prohibited to use weapons indiscriminately, which we found that the pager attacks were. The people who detonated the pagers did not know who was given the pagers or the walkie-talkies, and they did not know who would be around the individuals carrying those pagers and walkie-talkies. Therefore, the attack was indiscriminate and therefore unlawful under international humanitarian law and should be investigated as a war crime. The reason that Amnesty has called for an international investigation on this particular attack is because of the risks of this kind of warfare. It transforms everyday objects like pagers and walkie-talkies into essentially booby traps. And there is an explicit prohibition under international humanitarian law on the use of such booby traps. But we felt that, you know, such an attack, although it didn't cause nearly the same number of casualties as Monday's onslaught, did instill some fear and panic into the Lebanese society and is a really dangerous method of warfare to be using. It was unprecedented. And the involvement goes far beyond just, you know, the Israeli military. There are allegations around various shell companies. So we're trying to look into all of the multifaceted aspects of this attack, but we do feel that an international investigation in this case is warranted.
I want to ask you, Ms. Jazoob, if you consider this a war on Hezbollah or Israel's war on Lebanon?
I mean, in terms of the impact on civilians, it is undeniable that Lebanese civilians are paying the price. You know, a lot of the media coverage of Monday's attacks was Israel strikes Hezbollah targets. However, you know, we've looked at entire neighborhoods that have been flattened, residential towers that have been brought down, people's livelihoods, their shops, their homes, their cars, all in ruins. You mentioned the deaths of the two UNHCR staff members. The health minister also mentioned the deaths of four medics and paramedics. Ambulances are being hit, medical centers. And, you know, the wave of displacement from South Lebanon, the Bekaa, and other areas is now, I think, almost 500,000 people have had to leave their homes. Not all 500,000 people are Hezbollah. So the impact on Lebanese civilians has really been catastrophic.
And the response of the United States, President Biden just gave his last speech at the United Nations as U.S. president. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has characterized this as almost a full-fledged war. President Biden said too many on each side of the Israeli-Lebanon border remain displaced. Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest, even though a situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is not possible, is still possible, he said. IMS Jube, at the same time, the U.S. continuing to provide billions of dollars to the U.S. military, to the Israeli military.
Yeah, I mean, there's an obvious hypocrisy there. We've consistently, since October 7, have been calling for the suspension of weapons sales and shipments to Israel. We've continued to call for respect of IHL. We have, in at least one instance, documented a possible war crime that Israel committed in Lebanon using U.S. weapons. So if the U.S. really was serious about a de-escalation in the region, then they should start by stopping arms and weapons shipments to Israel, and by also supporting judicial criminal proceedings, including at the ICC.
IMS Jazoob, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Middle East and North Africa, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. Next up. Here in the U.S., Election Day is just six weeks away. We'll be joined by the Green Party presidential and vice presidential candidates, Jill Stein and Butch Ware. Stay with us. Strength Through Change by Lee Dines and the Jazz Tellers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. With Election Day less than 6 weeks away, we're joined now by Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein and her running mate, Butch Ware, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. On Friday, the Green Party suffered a setback when the U.S. Supreme Court declined a request to put Stein on the presidential ballot in Nevada. The Democratic Party had sued to keep Stein off the ballot for failing to submit the proper forms. This comes as support for Stein has been growing in some areas over Vice President Kamala Harris's refusal to call for an arms embargo on Israel. CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, last month published a survey that showed Stein is leading Harris among Muslim voters in three battleground states, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. MPAC, the Muslim Affairs Public Affairs Council, the Muslim American Public Affairs Council, also recently endorsed Stein. This is Dr. Stein's third run for the presidency. Many Democrats view her as a spoiler candidate, pointing to the 2016 election when Hillary Clinton narrowly lost to Donald Trump. In that election, Clinton lost to Trump in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin by fewer votes than Stein had received. In this campaign cycle, Democrats have fought to keep the Green Party off the ballot, while some supporters of Trump have helped Green Party with obtaining ballot access. Former Trump lawyer Jay Sekulow recently represented the Green Party in its efforts to be placed on the Nevada ballot at the U.S. Supreme Court. Stein, though, like Ralph Nader before her, has described her campaign as one taking on the two-party duopoly in the United States. Jill Stein joins us from Boston, and Butch Ware joins us from Santa Barbara, where he teaches at UC Santa Barbara about the history of Africa and Islam. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start, Jill Stein, by you telling us why you're running for president. What is you see is most important right now?
Well, let's put it this way. The American people are in crisis in virtually every dimension of our lives, whether it's the healthcare crisis and not being able to afford your pharmaceuticals. Some 8 million Americans are not able to afford their medications. 18 million were driven into poverty by the cost of healthcare in the last year for which data was available. Half of all Americans are struggling to keep a roof over their heads, severely economically stressed, trying to just pay their rent. You know, and we are spending half of our congressional dollars on the endless war machine, of which the this genocidal war against Gaza is one example that the American people vehemently object to. The American people are calling for other options. You know, who is anyone to say they should be denied, and that the two zombie political parties that have so poorly served the American public are the only options? You know, democracy is about competition. The American people are begging for other options. They are entitled to know who those options are. It speaks volumes that the Democrats are pulling out all the stops, including fraudulent impersonations of the Green Party, hiring infiltrators and spies, which they have publicly advertised for, and hiring an army of lawyers, in their own words, to basically throw their competitors off the ballot, quite simply because they are terrified of actually meeting us in the court of public opinion and having a real debate about the crises that the American people face and the real solutions that we alone are putting on the table, from Medicare for all to free public higher education to rent control across the country to 15 million units of so-called social housing, which would meet our housing needs, cutting the military budget, and above all, ending the genocidal war on Gaza right now, which the American people overwhelmingly support. A near supermajority actually supports a weapons embargo right now. And with Israel expanding this war, not only into the West Bank, but also now into Lebanon, this is extremely, extraordinarily dangerous. And when we hear the Biden-Harris administration say that, oh, there's nothing they can do, their hands are tied, that's absolutely false. They can do like Ronald Reagan and simply make a phone call and instruct Israel that this genocidal assault is over.
Jill Stein, I wanted to ask you, immigration and border enforcement become a key issue in this election. There's a raging national debate on it. How do you and your proposals differ from those of Donald Trump or Harris?
Yes, and indeed, we've seen Harris and the Democratic Party continue